Good morning, everyone. It is the 5th of January 2022, the day before Epiphany. Good old Epiphany, the 11th day of Christmas today. Well, we have snow up here in the Adirondacks. We have a little bit of a situation, actually, with the snow and the pandemic. And there were only 4 kids in my youngest child's class at school yesterday. Only 4 kids in class. But that's all right. A little tutorial session. One of the great things about our small town up here in the mountains is that everybody knows everybody else anyway. You know, the teachers are neighbors with their students. The teachers know their students from church youth groups, from community block parties, from being related to them. I would say probably about 25% to 30% of the staff at our public school system is related to someone else in the public school system in one way or another, maybe even higher than that, maybe 33%. That's actually a really interesting question. But that's life in a small town. Everybody knows everybody. So when you get 4 kids in a classroom due to people being snowed in, due to very, very sadly, we had a snowmobile accident in the community and a death that's really depressing spirits with some people up here. When you get 4 kids in a class because of all these hardships, then it's okay. You just carry on because it's like a family, but it was already like a family at that point. Today we're going to be looking at Spider-Man No Way Home. There are huge spoilers in this podcast. I mean, everything. We're going to talk about everything in Spider-Man 3. Complete spoilers. Do not listen to this episode if you do not want to hear spoilers about Spider-Man No Way Home or Spider-Man 3, but it's confusing to call it Spider-Man 3 for obvious reasons. Well, maybe not obvious, but there was another Spider-Man 3 under Sam Raimi, and in this movie there are 3 Spider-Men. Although they go by Peter 1, Peter 2, and Peter 3 rather than Spider-Man 1, 2, and 3. Still, we should think for a moment about the Stan Lee Revolution before we get into this. Go and listen to my podcast on the Stan Lee Revolution if you do not know how important Stan Lee was to literature in the 20th century and now the 21st century, right? Since his characters and plots and worlds are the foundation of the most successful movie franchise of the 21st century. The basic idea from that podcast, The Stan Lee Revolution, is that Stan changed the archetype of the hero from the Greek archetype, whose pain and problems were caused by something external to his nature as a hero, to a Christian archetype, right? And the Christian archetype, his pain and his problems are caused by his very nature as a hero. Jesus perished on the cross, suffered, went through the passion precisely because he was the Son of God. Did you see Hercules suffering because he was the son of Zeus? No, he was glorified for that. Some of the other gods might have come after him as a result of that. But in general, being the son of Zeus was a wonderful thing for him, and his problems were from hubris and from other sources. In the Marvel comics, what you see is that the heroes, because they have powers, they have all these tremendous difficulties in their lives. Hercules' strength did not cause him to have problems. Other things caused him to have problems, not the fact that he was a superhero. Tolkien almost did this, but Frodo's ring, even though it was a burden, that was really external to Frodo. It wasn't part of his nature. Lucas did this. Anakin's troubles were precisely because he was chock full of those midichlorians. He was a force sensitive par excellence. supreme in the galaxy. But because he had that force ability, that led to all of his problems. But Lucas came after Stanley. Lucas came after Lee. So Stan gets the credit for changing that archetype. And I go into it in much more detail in my podcast and how it influenced literature and exactly how that characterization works. So go and listen to that. But for today's Spider-Man 3 review, the point is that the Stan Lee revolution happened. It changed the way that we did heroes. The kryptonite is internal, not external in the Marvel universe. And Spider-Man, of course, first and foremost among Stan Lee's greatest characters, most popular character in the Marvel bullpen or stable, if you will. 9 major studio blockbuster releases in the past 20 years for Spider-Man. That's extraordinary, isn't it? 9 in the past 20 years for this one character, Spider-Man, right? The 3 Sam Raimis, the 3 with Tom Holland, the 2 with Andrew Garfield, and of course Into the Spider-Verse, Miles Morales Spider-Man there. That's a lot of movies in just 2 decades for one character, plus his appearances in Avengers. People love the character of Spider-Man. So there's also a lot to love about this movie. Very much so, but we need to start off and focus on the heart of Spider-Man 3, which is its absolutely bizarre morality. The moral messages here are just crazy mixed up, and I'm going to try to make sense out of them here for you. So, make sure we're on the same page. Recap the plot events here, and this is spoilers, major spoilers. Don't listen if you don't want to hear these. So, in the plot, you've got bad guys start coming through the universe. They're mass murderers. Peter and Doctor Strange get them all caged. Strange says, okay, we got to send them back to their universes where mostly they're going to die right away. In some case of Spider-Man himself in the alternate universe kills them because they're such bad dudes. But then Aunt May catches wind of this and she tells Spider-Man no. Aunt May says, no, you can't send these bad guys back to be killed. You have to save them. She uses the word cure them. I guess she thinks that their choices, their insanity is not something that their true selves didn't do. They have some soul, some supernatural homunculus sitting inside their consciousness that is good, and that soul somehow was forced to be evil. So we have to return the soul to its pure state, May says. You have to save these guys. And so Peter agrees with her, and he traps Doctor Strange, I think, over the Grand Canyon in some webs, just like a spider. And then Peter takes all the bad guys. He tries to cure them, but one of the bad guys escapes. He convinces the other bad guys to start being bad again. And then after they've escaped, Green Goblin just kills Aunt May. And then eventually Peter gets things back under control, sort of, but to do it, to get things back under control at the very end, he has to erase himself from existence. He loses his love, MJ. He loses his best friend, Ned. He loses his plans of getting into MIT, because the only way to prevent the universe from disintegrating is to have Doctor Strange erase the memory of Spider-Man. So basically, by following Aunt May's moral advice to try to save these guys, he ends up, Spider-Man ends up miserable. He loses his aunt. She gets killed. He loses his girlfriend. He loses his best friend. He loses his entire existence, pretty much. Anybody he's ever related to, except, of course, J. Jonah Jameson still hates Spider-Man, but he just doesn't know that he's Peter Parker. So what are we to make of this? This seems very confusing, because Doctor Strange said, no, Peter, you can't mess with the fate of an individual life. That's how the writers put it in one of the interviews. You have to let these guys face their punishment, face the consequences of their actions. And Spider-Man says, no, I'm going to try to cure them, which is to change their thinking, to change their decision-making processes. And Spider-Man does. He follows Aunt May's advice, and then every misery results. Absolute misery for Peter Parker. And what does he gain? I mean, not much. The villains, I guess, are supposedly saved, but they return back to their universes. Are we supposed to think that when they materialize back in their universe, Spider-Man there somehow realizes that they're good now and doesn't, you know, let the glider impale the Green Goblin at the end? Are we supposed to think that this saved villains are going to go on to peaceful lives and do good back in their universes? That's a huge stretch. It all the movie shows us is that they turn into these sort of golden silhouettes, these golden ectoplasmic forms, and then they vaporize. And given what the movie had set up before, that they were just about to die back in their universes, I don't see them returning and somehow doing good. They're going to be killed, or they are going to perhaps revert to their old ways, because just, you know, because they are good people now doesn't mean they won't turn into bad people again in the future, right? I mean, they all started off as good people, but then they became bad people. Far more through volition and choice than Spider-Man No Way Home would have you believe, by the way. So that's very strange. And at first, I thought that the writers were just confused. I thought, hey, they don't know what they're doing. They've got Aunt May giving this advice that is plainly terrible, but Aunt May is a good guy. Peter loves her. MJ respects her. Everybody who knows her is on her side. She doesn't have monstrous makeup. She doesn't have evil theme music. So the writers, directors must think she's a good guy giving good moral advice. Then, however, I actually dug into it. I read some interviews, and yes, the writers, McKenna and Summers, they say that she is Peter's moral compass, but they never actually say she's a good moral compass. In fact, in a Variety interview, they say that following May's advice blew up in Peter's face. They call Peter Parker naive. They say that the opposite of May, Doctor Strange, they say he's the voice of reason. Here's a quote. Either way, Doctor Strange was the voice of reason, going, you don't mess with the fate of an individual. And Peter Parker being naive enough to go, why not? Why can't we save these people? That's how they described it in this interview with Variety. So they seem to understand that May's advice destroyed Peter's life. Meanwhile, everyone in the fan world, though, is still assuming that May is a good moral compass. So the writers are leaving open. They say, yeah, she's a moral compass, but they don't necessarily say she's a good moral compass. It seems like they're acknowledging that she steered him in a way that maybe they're not saying is evil, but at least destroyed his life. But out in the fan world, everybody just assumes May is the good moral compass. You know, they are saying things like she's the heart of the movie. And they are saying things like, you know, May is the one that Peter can rely on to have a good conscience and to keep his soul pure and to avoid becoming a bad guy himself. I don't know that that's supported by the writer's statements. It's very, very much a bit of a mess. The writers very well could be saying that May is a bad moral compass. The other option that they could be saying is that being moral is a disaster, right? There, let's break it down here. Two different options. One, the writers are saying that May's the good guy and Strange is the bad guy. Can't have them both be the good guys because they're saying opposite things. So if the writers are intending to say that May is the good guy, well, then they're saying the message of the movie is that being moral will destroy your life, or at least can destroy your life, that morality is opposed to reason, because Doctor Strange definitely represents the voice of reason, and that following, you know, the right morals will lose you your love, will you lose you your family, will lose you your entire life. This is an odd message for a Disney film. A very, very dark for a Disney film. And the movie doesn't, you know, it has so much humor in it and it has so much other stuff. It doesn't seem to be wanting to say such a dark message. But that's what you get if you choose that May is the good compass and Doctor Strange is the bad compass. On the other hand, if you choose that May is a bad moral compass and Doctor Strange, as the voice of reason, is a good moral compass, then you're forced to conclude that number one, the fan world is completely misconstruing the character of May. You're also forced to conclude that the writers put this phrase, "With great power comes great responsibility," in the mouth of a bad guy, because Aunt May is the one who says, "With great power comes great responsibility," in this movie. Now, that line is so sacrosanct in Marvel lore that I can hardly imagine you have a bad guy say it. That is constantly referred to, not just in Marvel lore, but in pop culture in general, as a good guiding principle, a moral statement that is sound and one that should be hewn to by the best among us. So if you're choosing that May is the bad guy, then why on earth are you putting this revered statement into her mouth, coming out of her lips? That doesn't seem to make sense. Also, if you do say that May is the bad guy, then you're going against history. You're going against the character in Marvel Comics that represented all kinds of wonderful, wholesome qualities, and you are turning her into this life-destroying demon of a character, a complete turnaround from the character that existed in the comics, and that just doesn't fit in with the way the Marvel Cinematic Universe has in general interpreted the source material. I don't think that there is another character that would have undergone anything like that transformation that would be necessary to have May become the voice of evil in this movie. So I think it's a mess. I think the writers are being inconsistent. I think that they are not rigorously applying their principles and their thought process to all the different facets of this movie. Right? If you choose, I just went through it. If you choose that May is the voice of good, then you're saying this move, the moral of this movie is that you choose to be good, you're going to get your life destroyed. And if you choose that May is the voice of evil, then you've got all these other problems with an inconsistent character versus the comics and with everything else. So there are good reasons that each choice is wrong, and I think that the writers and the director just waffle back and forth between these choices at different times, and the movie ends up not having any sort of a coherent moral message. And that's sad. That's really too bad, because otherwise it's a great movie. The humor in this movie is outrageously great. I was laughing more at this movie than I have since a Marvel movie since Thor Ragnarok. It's that funny. The line about the cool youth pastor, you're gonna come, you're gonna get your costume on, or you're gonna come do this dressed as a cool youth pastor to Tobey Maguire. That was perfect. Chef's kiss gets overused these days, but I have to say, chef's kiss on that moment, that was absolutely amazing and spectacular, to use a few Spider-Man adjectives. And of course, the whole Spider-Man 3, Spider-Man 2, or Peter 2, Peter 3, Peter 1 interactions at the end, the humor about the web fluid coming internally out of Peter 2, Andrew Garfield hanging his head when he's deemed to be Peter 3, even though he's the middle brother. It just really, really exquisitely crafted humor right there. And the action sequences are incredible, and the acting is amazing. Willem Dafoe, of course, going back to Raven Shattuck and Streets of Fire, he was just born to play villains. He's like Shaquille O'Neal of villains. He was just born to do that. You look at him and you're like, oh, you're a Hollywood villain. Yeah, okay, that's it. That's what you were born to do. And so he's perfectly placed here. Absolutely amazing stuff there. And, for the Marvel geek inside all of us, the insights into the lore was amazing. Even the callbacks to the extra Marvel stuff, like the superb first two, not the third, but the first two Sam Raimi films with Tobey Maguire, we get to learn, for example, that Tobey and MJ are still together in that movie. And wasn't it wonderful? Remember how at the end of Spider-Man 2, MJ, Kirsten Dunst, says to Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man, she says to Peter Parker, it's about time someone saved you. Someone needs to save you. And wasn't that beautifully echoed when Zendaya said to Peter 3, said to Andrew Garfield after he saved her, after being unable to save Gwen Stacy, wasn't that beautifully echoed when he said, "Are you all right?" And then Zendaya said, "Are you all right?" That was just, gave me the shivers. It gave me the chills. So wonderful art. Absolutely inspiring right there. Unfortunately, the movie failed completely on its morality. It reminds me, in fact, of The Picture of Dorian Gray. If you think of Oscar Wilde in The Picture of Dorian Gray, then what you're going to see, or what you're going to remember, is that throughout the Picture of Dorian Gray, and in many of Wilde's comments, to both publicly and privately, Wilde was a champion of sort of art for art's sake and aesthetics only for the sake of aesthetics. And in Picture of Dorian Gray, what you've got is this wonderful interplay between aesthetics and ethics, between art and morality, where the picture is the one that's aging and the real Dorian Gray is allowed to live this decadent, artful, fantastic life. And you've put art at the center, and art is the thing that is aging instead of the human body. And Wilde builds up this value in art, that art is a value in and of itself. But unfortunately, then at the end, Wilde, almost in spite of himself, succumbs to the Christian ethic that had, of course, predominated the last 1700 years. That Christianity became the dominant religion about 300 AD, and Wilde wrote this at the end of the 19th century. So at the end of the novel, Wilde succumbs to this idea that, seeking immortal life here on earth is not morally okay. He succumbs to this idea that living for beauty and creating beauty and creating art with no other moral purpose than creating art is not okay, and that is immoral, and it all comes crashing down, and Dorian Gray, dies and presumably goes to hell, and all the art and the beauty that was based on this, un-Christian ethos falls apart, decays, and it's gone. The whole thing collapses. So, just like Wilde fell prey to a morality that in some sense did not fit the rest of his book, I feel that the makers, Watts, the director, and Summers and McKenna, the writers of this Spider-Man movie here, have fallen prey to a morality that isn't their own. I think that they want to say that it's good to live for other people, that it's good to try to save everybody. They want to side with May, but then when they think about it reasonably and they look at the way their movie actually turned out, they think, "Ooh, yeah, that really doesn't make sense, does it? That doesn't work out too well." But nonetheless, May represents the good moral path, divergent from the reasonable rational path. That's a shame. Of course, the truth is that morality and rationality are not dichotomous. They do, in fact, have common purpose and common essence, if you will. Finally, I would like to say about Spider-Man 3 that you should consider it in light of Thomas Shaw's classic mid-20th century book, The Myth of Mental Illness. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, "Frank, come on now. You are on leave from your teaching job because you cannot abide to wear the masks. You have the school gave you this waiver that was supposedly an Americans with Disability Act waiver. You got all this filled out by your doctors and your lawyers and everything else. then your school said, oh, at the last minute, oh no, you can't come in. Sorry, even though you have this mental illness, you need to stay home. We can't accommodate your disability this year. So how are you going to pick on the concept of mental illness? Well, I'll tell you how. Thomas Shaws was right. Mental illness is a fundamentally different idea than physical illness. So different that we really shouldn't use the word illness for it. And the reason is that as soon as you start defining someone's behavior, someone's choices, regardless of their causes, as soon as you just start defining it as pathological, that gives you an excuse to force that person to do what is right. That gives the government of the, Shaz was particularly concerned with the Gulag Archipelago, Solzhenitsyn's term, the Gulag Archipelago of Siberia. And it gives the Soviet Union, this idea of mental illness, gives the Soviet Union an excuse to say, oh, you're opposed to communism, you must be mentally ill, so we'll lock you up and we'll re-educate you and we'll rehabilitate you and we will cure you of your mental illness so that you support communism, right? Like the Ludovico treatment in Clockwork Orange that was so controversial that that chapter was even banned, or at least eliminated from the novel, I should say, in some releases. So, thinking of this in terms of Spider-Man 3, what we see is that May wants to do what the Soviet Union did. May wants to go against Shaz and say, we need to cure these people of their mental illness. We have the right, because they're sick, to go and force them to change their minds, literally change their minds. And so May encourages Peter to do this, and he does against their will. Now they're murderers, so I'm not going to say that they had the right to be free from this interference. But Peter goes, and against their will, he alters their consciousness. Huh. This is something you need to be very, very, very careful of, right? Just because someone thinks differently than you do does not mean that it is a disease that you have the right to cure. Even if in some way the term illness applies, that doesn't mean that you have the right to force them to accept some, you injecting some chemicals into their body. Literally, those syringes that Peter Parker slapped into Osborn make me think of some sort of forced injection. I'm sure you can draw some parallels even to the current pandemic with forced vaccination. Made me think of some forced chemicals, forced injections that various governments have inflicted upon their citizens. Never forget, hashtag never forget, that the United States government was forcibly sterilizing American Indian women into the 1970s. That's right, into the 1970s. My lifetime, in fact, within my lifetime, the United States government was still forcibly sterilizing American Indian women. So American Indian women, not all of them, obviously, but some. And that's what matters. So, and they were doing it, of course, in the name of morality. They thought they were morally justified. So I would encourage you to read Thomas Shaw's book, The Myth of Mental Illness, when you are thinking about Aunt May's command to Peter Parker to seize the bad guys and force some chemicals into their body. Think about mental illness and what it does or does not give other people permission to do. We've made a lot of progress on that this year with the Free Britney Spears campaign. Great to see that. Very, very positive development. And perhaps that's where we will wrap things up for today on that positive note with Britney Spears. tomorrow we will be back at it. Can't wait to go into tomorrow's first poetry episode of 2006. It'll be an epiphany episode. 2006, January 6th, 2022. It will be an epiphany episode. The wise men will arrive. In the meantime, please remember to like, subscribe, and comment. Find me on Twitter, ADK Homeroom. Find me at Substack, ADK Homeroom. And, of course, on Getter. Is that how you pronounce that? The new one that Joe Rogan just went to? Getter? Find me on Getter, ADK Homeroom. Take care, everyone. And, yeah, maybe we'll sign off everything this year with the new tag phrase, FDA Delenda Est, CDC Delenda Est. I don't know. It's true. Kind of like take care better, though. Take care, folks.